No holding back. It's cricket, only better.
What an innings, what a player. Take a bow, Ben Stokes.
Brian Charles Lara becomes the first man in the history of the game to register a score of 400.
Six sixes in an over. Yuvraj Singh finishes things off in style.
England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins.
Betfair Betting Podcast presents Cricket, Only Better.
Welcome, you lucky people, to a middle stump out the ground episode of Cricket, Only Better. I'm Ed Hawkins, the ghost of Whispering Death.
I mean, what was that? I'm Sam Collins, astounded. Not only that you're trying to make yourself another incredibly spurious title, but also that you're completely undermining our credibility on the day when we're welcoming a really big name guest for everybody. Guys, we have today on the show joining us a genuine legend of the game, one of the greatest fast bowlers ever, 249 test wickets, the closest the game has to a moral authority, one of the people who is a fan of the game going into working in it. They completely lived up to everything I hope they would be. And I know you know him very well, but Michael Holding is joining us today.
Yeah, indeed. Just to give context to my spooky beginning, I was just trying to wrong foot people, get people listening. What's he talking about this week? Oh, he's lost it. I used to be...
Oh, dear. We sunk that low.
I did ghost his autobiography a long time ago, and he also used to write about cricket for the Racing Post many moons ago. So that is why he is here.
Yes, and we're really looking forward to hearing what he's got to say about Jofra Archer, head of the New Zealand-England Test Series. What else will we be talking to him about?
Well, we'll talk about the modern use of data, whether it had been any use to him when he was playing. We'll talk about the fast bowling stocks around the world as well. Who are the main players to look out for? Who are the emerging talent on the fast bowling circuit? Because we seem to be blessed with a lot of good fast bowlers at the moment, and it wasn't always the case a few years ago. So it'd be great to get his views on that.
Okay, fantastic. Also on the show, we have Freddie Wild, our regular analyst, returning to dissect India versus Bangladesh and to look at the prices ahead of the New Zealand-England Test Series. And there is also Mythbuster. Who's that going to be, Edward?
Ooh, prizes for who it might be. Have a guess.
Now we've got Freddie Wild, cricket analyst, talking India versus Bangladesh. The first test kicks off on Thursday in Indore at the Holkar Stadium. Betfair Sportsbook are going 1-7 India, Bangladesh 11-1, and the draw 15-2.
Yeah, and in the last 4 years, India have batted first at home 15 times, and they've won 13 of those and drawn two. When they field first, they've done it 10 times over the same study period. They've won 6, lost 1 and drawn 3. So, in short, Bangladesh have to bat first to stand any chance whatsoever.
So, I'm guessing that the interest here comes from looking at the individual player markets. Is that right?
Yes, and we've got two of the best in Virat Kohli for runs and Ravi Ashwin for wickets. And Freddie, you're on the line now. Can you give us something where we can use the line? I love it when a plan comes together with regards to those two players.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you said, I mean, Kohli and Ashwin, I mean, Kohli anywhere in the world, but Ashwin particularly in India, are particularly, you know, exceptionally dominant. And it's hard to look beyond either of those two in those two markets. There are a couple of other players which offer potential interest. I mean, one of the things that... people often focus on in Asian test matches are the spinners. Bangladesh's record generally in test cricket against spin bowling is better than it is against pace bowling. We actually saw recently in the India South Africa series, some of India's quicks, particularly Mohammad Shami, collect quite a few wickets. So there might be some value in backing one of the Indian pacers to do well, particularly in that second test in Kolkata, which will be under lights. And there's the pink ball under lights does do a little bit more, so maybe backing one of the quicks. India obviously rotate those quicks in and out a little bit, but Shami is one of the ones who stands out as a potential top wicket taker.
Mohammad Shami 4-1 with Betfair Sportsbook for the top wicket taker in the first test. Virat Kohli, who has a record of nine wins in his last 20 on the top batsman for India. Sportsbook go 2-1, and he's actually more like 5-4 on the 2-year form. Ravi Ashwin's record is extraordinary for a top bowler, 7 wins from the last 15, 2 ties. So he's more like 11-10, and Sportsbook go 11-4. Anyone likely to upset Kohli in that market? Chet Pujara's got a pretty good record, 5 wins from 20, but we're also seeing the rise of Rohit, Freddie.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, Pujara is a sort of obvious second in line after Virat, but Rohit's phenomenal series against South Africa sort of throws him into contention, I guess. I mean, it would be pretty remarkable if he can continue that run of form. I don't think we can expect him to maintain what he did against South Africa on a consistent basis. But, you know, he's obviously a quality player, and he's got to be in the reckoning as well. I mean, Mayank Agarwal as well, as the other opener alongside Rohit, probably hasn't attracted quite as much attention because he's not had the name of Rohit in white ball cricket, and he's a little bit more of an understated player. But Agarwal's had a solid start to his career as well. So, I mean, one of those top four, I don't think you can look really beyond them. Obviously, you've got Rahane at 5. He sort of sneaks under the radar a little bit more.
How do we work out the individual markets for Bangladesh? Because they haven't got Shakib, and that's probably not a bad thing because he'd not won in his last 5. So you'd probably discounted him anywhere for big runs or bigger runs than anybody else in the first innings of the first test. Anyone you fancy, Freddie, to go well from Bangladesh? Because let's face it, people don't know a lot about this Bangladesh test team. So give us some insight.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, Mushfiqur Rahim is probably the outstanding batsman in that team, especially once Shakib isn't there. Mushfiqur, I mean, he's an experienced player, and he's someone who in Shakib's absence will be expected to stand up. From a bowling perspective, Mehdi Hasan is probably one of their premier spin bowlers, and someone who, again, with Shakib not being there, is going to have to stand up. I mean, that's the thing with this team. There's quite a few, in fact, sort of decent players who've been consistent for a while at test level. Mahmudullah is another player. Mustafa Zour obviously comes in and out of the side. These sort of quality players who are going to have to now basically step up and take over or fill the rather large shoes of Shakib. Who contributes with both bat and ball. But yeah, I mean, for Mushfiqur is probably the sort of standout one there. The bowling's a little bit more difficult to call.
Yeah, Mushy 4-1 with Betfair Sportsbook to be top Bangladesh run scorer in that first test, first innings. I can give you a breakdown of how many times he actually wins as well. No, he's 1-1 out of the last 9. But again, the study period's not huge. And we're in the dark a bit because Bangladesh have only played about 11 tests, I think, in the last 2 years. So we don't have a huge amount to go on. And I think you mentioned Mehdi Hasan for top Bangladesh bowler. And he's second favourite at 10-3. What can you tell us about the pitch at Indore?
Well, yeah, as you said, I mean, there's only been one test match played there. So going off test data is difficult. We've got, since 2013, there's been 23 first-class games there. 6 have been won by the team batting first and 8 by the team fielding first, with 9 draws. 9 draws is quite a large amount, so I expect quite a flat pitch. I know the boundaries are quite small at Indore as well. So bat maybe dominating ball is something that we see in Asian test matches generally early on. We can probably see similar here in Indore. Again, as you said, the toss will be pivotal. With India win the toss, it's hard to look past them, but Bangladesh, if they can bat first, might get the chance to pile on a relatively big score and put some pressure on India. But as is so often the case, a lot's going to be resting on that toss.
Freddie Wild is still with us. Mikey Holding's still to come. Sam, we're moving on to the New Zealand versus England 2-test series.
Yeah, the mammoth 2-test series starting November 20th. Series prices, New Zealand 23-10, England 6-4, the draw 8-5. Freddie, what can you tell us about this test series?
Well, it's a very interesting series. I think it's an extremely difficult one to call off. These two teams are pretty evenly matched. Obviously, we've just seen England give up the Ashes against Australia at home in a series that they drew. New Zealand are, again, a similar team. Sort of, they kept at their best, they're very good. They're at their worst, they're not so good, like England, who have had some dramatic collapses in the last few years. So it's a difficult one to call, and you sort of feel like conditions, particularly in New Zealand, where the ball can move around and do quite a bit, Who gets the best of those conditions is going to be important. It's going to be a really interesting series because obviously England post-Ashes have brought in some new younger players, whereas New Zealand are probably sort of with this core group that they've used for quite a few years now, almost at a point where you feel like they're at an apex, and this, you know, this series, and then obviously going to Australia afterwards is a season for them in which they can really create a bit of a legacy, I suppose. So there's a lot of narrative to both teams coming into this, and as I said, I think it's a difficult one to call.
Again, people won't know a lot about the New Zealand team. Who's stand out for you, particularly with the ball? Because Kane Williamson is well known for being an absolute run machine. But what about their wicket takers?
Yeah, well, I mean, Bolt and Southee are the two. They've been central to their attack for a number of years. But Neil Wagner is probably someone who sneaks under the radar. The left arm quick, he bowls a lot of short balls, and he's an aggressive bowler. And then there's, I think, Lockie Ferguson seems to be pushing for red ball inclusion, having dominated the white ball scene for a while. He's a rapid right arm quick. I'm sure people will have seen him in the World Cup, and obviously he played the first couple of T20s in the series. He's also likely to be a wicket taker. They've got a really attacking bowling unit, which, as I said, alluded to earlier, those conditions in New Zealand often help seam bowlers, and you expect that those, well, Southee and Bolt, and then probably be partnered by Wagner or Ferguson. It's a pretty potent attack. De Gronda Mosk also will probably fulfil an all-rounder role. They've got quite a few options there. All of them are, as I said, aggressive bowlers who look for wickets. So there's plenty of competition for a top wicket taker.
Betfair Sportsbook go 9-5, a 1-1 draw, Freddie. There's not a huge amount to choose between the teams. Does that price float your boat?
Yeah, as I said at the top, it's a very difficult series to call. I think that these two teams are evenly matched, and I think getting the best of conditions will be crucial. I think England probably at their best. I reckon I would back them to beat New Zealand, but as we've seen following England in the last couple of years, they're so inconsistent at this level. They're very much up and down, and they've got quite a few new names in that team. It's a little bit hard to say how they'll go. Whereas in New Zealand, you can probably be a bit more confident how they'll go. They're a solid team. England are more up and down, and as a result, that is a difficult series to call as well. And I say, yeah, 1-1 probably sounds fair enough. You sort of feel like over two games, England will get the best of them sometimes, and New Zealand will return it at some point as well. But equally, England, as I said, they've shown a tendency to collapse in recent times, particularly away from home. And if New Zealand were to win two tosses, and as teams often do in New Zealand, teams choose to bowl first and put the other team in on what are typically green pitches, you could see New Zealand equally running away with it. Obviously, last time England toured New Zealand, they were bowled out in a session for 58, I think. So they haven't got some good memories of playing down there.
Rory Burns, 9-2 with Betfair Sportsbook to be top England series run scorer. I like that price, Freddie, because he did particularly well in the Ashes. He did get pipped by Ben Stokes for the top of the charts in that series. But he's very solid, isn't he? And his temperament is excellent. And he scored runs against a very good Australia attack. The Kiwis are going to be challenging, but probably not quite as good as the Aussies. Have you got anything to suggest that he's going to go well again?
Well, I mean, I suppose the best case for Burns is almost the absence of quality competitors. Obviously, we're not sure. We expect to see Dom Sibley, I think, join him at the top of the order. Zach Crawley is a bit more of the outsider, but essentially we're going to have probably a new opening partner for Burns in one of those two. So you don't really know what you're getting there. And then you've got England's suspect middle order, guys like Butler, Stokes, Denley, who might be in the frame as well. Obviously, Bairstow's now been added. And obviously, then there's Joe Root, the captain, who's probably the best bet to be top run scorer. But you're right, Burns is a good shout in that respect, in that he's sort of a little bit more established. He's played, for a home season and for a couple of tests away last winter, or a few tests away last winter. And he's a battling competitor. He's the kind of guy you sort of feel like could probably get through the new ball. And if he can do that, in New Zealand, he might be able to cash in. Burns is a good shout, simply, as I said, for the lack of other options. England's batting is so raw and so inconsistent that the solidity of Burns, he's banged out 1,000 runs in first-class cricket for the last five or six seasons. He knows his game. And in that sense, he's a step ahead of most of the other guys in that batting order.
Lovely stuff, Freddie. Freddie's going to be joining us again as a regular guest on Cricket Only Better.
Hi, I'm Michael Holding, and this is Cricket Only Better.
It's time for Mythbuster. And a very special Mythbuster today, because it is none other than our special guest, Michael Holding. The question is, how many times would you have won money betting on him to be the top West Indies wicket taker in the first innings of his glory-soaked 60-match test career? Can you believe he only played 60 test matches?
Well, that was the era, wasn't it? They just didn't pack in those all those games back then, I guess.
Incredible. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. So before I do my computer voice to give you the thoughts of odds maker Kevin McAvoy from Betfair Sportsbook, a bit of housekeeping. Congratulations to @FayeDazouz, who correctly guessed this week's buster when Ed quizzed his Twitter followers. What does he win?
I'm going to give him a free download of my latest book, which is called Men on Magic Carpets.
Oh my, I mean, that must be, how much is that worth?
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked on the price on Amazon because I don't want to look at the price on Amazon.
Oh, dearie me. Well, cut me in on some of that. That sounds like absolute gold dust. Selling like hotcakes. All the cliches. Okay, right. Mythbuster, Michael Holding. Sportsbook says of his average price for top West Indies wicket taker in the first innings.
Are you going to do your computer voice?
I was just prepping for it because I was sort of... Okay. My accents, I can't just summon them on demand.
Okay. If you can guess the nationality, somebody can win another download of my book.
I would say the average price... No, I've got to start that again. I would say the average price in tests, 3-1, or possibly even as big as 7-2. During the early stages of his international career, he was probably a touch shorter. But during the latter stages of his career, when you had the likes of Marshall, Garner and Walsh all in the same 11, he would have been closer to 4-1 or 9-2, I would imagine.
Bit Boston Irish, I thought.
I'm so sorry. I'm just feeling self-loathing through every second of that.
I don't think there's anything to add. We went with 7-2. Holding 16 outright wins in 60 tests, 3 in a row, with each a 5-wicket haul at the MCG, SCG and Adelaide in 81, 82. 6 times he shared honours. Up or down, Sam? Up or down?
I just want to believe, have to believe that he's up. Otherwise, there's no justice. And that, frankly, there's no point in Mythbuster if that does not leave you up.
Michael Holding not only comes on to rescue the show.
Rescue? Why? What? Have you put us in?
He rescues Mythbuster. Up a massive £285 to £10 level stakes. If you needed any more proof, the man was a legend. And he goes straight to the top of the Mythbuster charts. Probably never be caught. Holding plus 285. Tendulkar in second place plus £1.80. Pathetic. Wow. And then Warne minus, we're in the minuses, 11750. Lara minus 130. Bradman, biggest, most overrated all time. Bradman minus 155.
But wait, so how have Betfair got this so wrong? How have Betfair priced him so badly?
I don't think they've necessarily priced him badly.
But how is the average man up 285 quid then?
Because the answer is in that 60 test career. If Tendulkar had played 60 tests, or Lara had played 60 tests, or Warne, or actually Bradman played about 50, didn't he? Gosh, a really bad value. But that's probably why he's making you money. And the other reason why, he was darn good.
Okay, let's leave it at that.
And as if by magic, here is the man himself. Welcome to Cricket Only Better.
Thank you very much, Ed. Glad to be joining you guys.
I wanted to start off by telling you something you may or may not be interested in. And if you'd backed Michael Holding to be top West Indies first innings wicket taker in each of your 60 tests, you'd been up a massive £280, Mikey. And to put that in context,
Whoa. The
only person who is plus at the moment is Tendulkar at £1.80, and Bradman cost you 155 quid.
Whoa.
Where does that rank on your litany of achievements?
I should have been betting when I was playing then. I'll be a rich man now.
Good stuff.
The only thing is I didn't know anything about betting on cricket those days. I had no idea people betted on cricket.
Yeah, I suppose they didn't actually in the 70s and 80s. It wasn't the massive industry it is now. But sort of looking ahead, kicking off to New Zealand-England Test Series coming up next week, we wanted to ask you about Jofra Archer and whether you ever felt that there was some similarity in that laconic run-up, because he's very easy on the eye and you were quite good running to the wicket as well.
Yeah, I don't try to compare people with myself. You know, Ed. If people want to make that comparison, I leave other people to do that. You know, quite a few people have been telling me, oh, you remind me of you. I don't even think about it. I just let that go through one ear and go out the next. Because I don't go play that game. I am just not interested. If I was to try to compare him with someone else from West Indies, the first person I would think of would be Winston Benjamin. I think they have a quite similar run-up in that neither had a very long run-up. Both of them had very high, upright, and almost perfect bowling action. And that's the person that, just looking at him, I would compare or think of comparing him to first.
Jofra Archer, 94 with Betfair Sportsbook, to be top England series wicket taker. How good do you think he could be, Mikey?
Oh, he has certainly a potential to be a great fast bowler. He has already shown how good he is technically and, of course, with the pace that he has, because that is very important. You can't buy a pace. You either have it or you haven't, and then you can develop and use that pace along with other skills to be a great fast bowler. And I certainly think he has the potential to be one.
How do we make the most of someone like that? You were on record after Lords as saying that the amount he was bowled by Joe Root was almost abuse. How do we make the most of him and ensure that he has a long Test career?
Just by being sensible about it, just by knowing that it's flesh and blood, it's not a machine, and you have got to take care of someone like that. As I've said, not everyone has that sort of pace. People like that don't come along very often. So you have got to make sure you can use him sparingly and give him a very long career. You know, at the end of that Lord's Test, I think it was the Lord's Test, yes, someone sent me on WhatsApp, but he put out a picture of an old man with a cane, and his tweet with the picture was, "That's me getting out of bed this morning." So it's obvious that he was feeling the effects of the amount of work that he did in that test. And, you know, Sam and Ed, if that happens every now and again, once every 5 or 6 test matches, you can live with that, because sometimes a captain is going to want to use his strike bowler a little bit more than you would do normally. But that wasn't the situation with Jofra Archer in that series. And I kept on hearing people around me saying, oh, they need to win the test, so they have to use him. England might need to win every test match when Jofra Archer is playing. They might find themselves in a situation where they think, yes, we have to win this test match. England are not going to find themselves that often leading a series 3-0. So, you know, that is not a valid excuse. You have got to be more sensible than that.
Do you think he himself is sensible, Mikey? Because I think in response to your advice given out, obviously via media channels, that he needed to be looked after, he says he doesn't need to be looked after. What do you make of that?
Well, we will see. Any human being that doesn't think he needs to be looked after, we will see.
Do you think England have the capability to look after him? Who in that setup is going to realise that Jofra is somebody who needs to be nurtured and taken out of the firing line every so often to get the best out of him? Is that care and compassion there among those group of coaches, the captain?
Well, you should hope so. It doesn't take a lot. You know, I played county cricket for Derbyshire, and Kim Barnett was my captain at the time. And I was a senior player. I didn't play county cricket until 1985, when I was 31 years old. I was senior. I was mature. I was strong enough. But Kim Barnett was also sensible enough to know that if I just kept on bowling, he would not get the best out of me. And it's just a simple thing like that. You have got to use your common sense.
It's difficult though, isn't it? Because doing it in county cricket back then, as opposed to doing it now when the media are demanding success, again, you know, game after game after game. If England can't look after Mark Wood, then how do we look after, you know, Jofra? That's the issue, isn't it? And I mean, do you think Chris Silverwood as a coach, you know, having a quick bowler as a coach, do you think that is positive for Jofra?
That should help, definitely, because Silverwood will know exactly what he is going through and what a human body can manage. He was a fast bowler. He knew exactly what he required to be effective and how long he had to bowl in various times to make sure that he prolonged his career. So certainly he would have an insight into all that. So you would hope that his influence will be a big thing where Jofra Archer is concerned.
Mikey, how much do you wish he was playing for West Indies?
No, I don't think about that, Ed. He's playing for England. I ain't going to think, oh, I wish he was playing for the West Indies. He made his choice, and whatever reason he used to make that choice, that is fine. You know, we West Indies have to move on.
Just a question about whether batters are able to analyse bowlers and counter them better once they've seen more of them. Because obviously bowlers have a good look at batsmen. Often batsmen, when they come onto the stage, it takes a while for the analysts to get into their technique and expose it. Is that the same with bowlers? Do bowlers get easier to play the longer batsmen have had to have a look at them?
Yes, for sure. You know, every bowler has something that the batsman will have to try and negotiate. With Jofra Archer, it's extreme pace for one. Forget about any other skills. Just think about the pace. The first time you come across someone with that extra pace, you're not accustomed to it. Your reactions aren't as good as they should be because you're not accustomed to having to move and react at that pace. But as time goes on, you adapt. Whether he can move the ball in either direction or those are just some things that you have to adapt to as a batsman. Similarly, just as a spin bowler, you know, a spin bowler is bowling to a batsman and the batsman initially can't pick the googly if he's a wrist spinner or can't pick the ball that goes away from him, the swinging ball of an off spinner. But as time goes on, he detects certain things that the bowler does that will help him to identify the various deliveries. Just like as a fast bowler, you know, it takes time to adjust to the extra pace. It takes time to know exactly the nuances of this particular fast bowler and how he does what.
When you watch him bowling, what do you think about his thought processes? How's he impressed you or not in that sense so far?
No, I have no fault whatsoever with anything that I've seen with him so far, whether it's his action or his thought processes or his skills. It's just a matter of no time showing us how he develops, how long he can carry this on for if he keeps on learning as time goes on. I wouldn't be able to look at Jofra Archer and say, well, he needs some help in this direction or some help in that direction or he needs to develop this skill or whatever. Time will tell us everything as time goes on.
No, I wasn't meaning that. I wasn't looking for you to criticise him there. I was more meaning that
I'm not criticising him either. What I'm seeing is a perfect fast bowling specimen. That's what I'm seeing. And that is what I'm talking about. You know, him now developing as time goes on and keeping that progression going, because you can't stand still, whether you're a batsman or a bowler. You've got to keep on getting better.
He's at the top of a long list of really sort of exciting fast bowling talent around the world. Why do you think there's suddenly such a lot of guys bowling quick now after such a dearth over the last few years?
To be honest, I see a lot of people bowling fast. You know, they're as fast and they're as fast. Jofra Archer and Rabada, I think, possibly are the two quickest around at the moment. India have some fast bowlers, but I wouldn't say any of them are frighteningly quick. I think Archer is the most frighteningly quick of them all.
Have you seen anybody emerging when you've been on your travels around the world? Someone like Mohammad Hasnain for Pakistan has caught the attention. Someone like Anrich Nortjay in South Africa, Mikey. Who should we be looking out for in the next couple of years who could really emerge in the same way that Archer has?
No, that's a difficult one. I don't see anybody with the natural talent and skills that Jofra Archer has along with his pace. I don't see anyone like that at the moment. There are guys that, you know, have pace, guys that you don't mess around with. You don't just push your front foot down the pitch at them because they're bowling high 80s. But remember, Archer hit almost mid-90s. That's quite a bit of difference. 8 miles per hour at the highest level is a lot different from 8 miles an hour difference, say, in the 70s or 80s. When you're jumping from 88 to 96, that's a huge jump, bigger jump than from 80 to 88.
Mikey, what do you make of the use of data in professional cricket now, particularly international cricket?
Well, you use whatever you can, you know, to help your game. If data, it depends on the type of data and how you use that data, but data per se is good. Whatever you can analyze your own game with or the opposition's game with is always going to be helpful. It's just a matter of how reliant you are on data. You can't be too reliant on data. You still have to use your own skills, and a lot of cricket is played in the head, not just with figures.
How do you think it would have changed the way you approached your game if you'd had access to that type of analysis when you were playing?
I don't think it would have changed our game that much, or my game that much, because when we played way back in the 70s and 80s, we didn't have the actual data, but we had our memory bank. And we used our memory bank, and we discussed things that we saw in opposition in our team meeting. We wouldn't have the exact data where he scores 67% of his runs in this quadrant, or he scores very few runs. And we didn't have that exact data. But we knew where batsmen were strong. We knew where they were weak. We knew where they played their shots. Just that we didn't have the exact data that is available now. So I don't think it would have really changed my game. Let me speak for myself. My game that much.
Do you get any sense from talking to, I don't know how much you talk to the guys who are playing now, or whether that having that data spoon fed to them actually affects the way that they process the game and analyse the game when they're playing it? Do you get any sense of whether that is the case or not?
If no data was available tomorrow, that they would all break down and not know what to do. I think they would still be able to play their game. And I think it's not just the data, but just reliance on support services. I remember way back in 2007, Michael Atherton interviewing a former England cricketer at the end of an Ashes series in Australia when England had done poorly. He was going home, wasn't playing in the One Days, and should be preparing for the Test series coming up that summer in England. And Atherton asked him, you know, what he intended to do between now when he's going home and when the first Test in England starts. And he said, oh, I'll have to wait and see what the coach says. No, that wouldn't really apply in my time or way back in the 70s and 80s. You just know what you have to do and go out and start working.
Thanks for coming on, Mikey. I hope we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you, Mikey.
My pleasure, Ed. No problem. And Sam, good to speak to you.
Yeah, really nice to chat to you, Mikey. Great news, people. It's the end of the show. None of that preposterous Crickonomics top five guff that Ed likes to wibble on about.
I'm just going to do five or six of them next week as punishment.
I'll just have my headphones on for that. Thank you very much for listening, all seven of you. We really hope you've enjoyed the show. Please continue to give us feedback via whichever medium you most prefer, at Cricket Betting, at Sampson Collins, various other forms. I'm sure you can find us on Spotify, LinkedIn, iTunes, etc. Deliveroo. I've used that joke already. Yes, please continue to bet responsibly, only if you're over 18 years old, only with money that you have. Please head to betting.betfair for all your cricket thoughts, hopes and needs, and more musings from Betfair's self-appointed head of cricket content, Edward Hawkins. And appropriately on that note, Edward, what have we got next week?
Well, we've got part two of the interview with the great man, Mikey Holding. So join us for more sage advice.
And we'll have some thoughts on how the England-New Zealand Test Series is going too.
Indeed. Until next time.